This is Michael Franti from Spearhead, and you listen to Hard Knock Radio, KPFA 94.1 in Berkeley, Monday through Friday, 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. So check it out.
Davey D hanging out with you this afternoon, Hard Knock Radio. On the phone line with us, good friend of the show. He's an author, professor over at University of Connecticut. He just wrote an article in the New Yorker that kind of analyzes and gives us a summary, an updated summary of the new wave of black politicians. Some people call them the safe black politicians. Others call them the David Axelrod politicians. We'll find out exactly what Jelani Cobb, our guest, likes to refer to them. Jelani, welcome to the show. And I wanted to have you on because last week there was a brouhaha involving Cory Booker. He is part of this new wave of black politicians who can appeal to blacks and whites, and they seem to play a very safe game. And he, of course, wound up being on opposite ends of where President Obama stands when it comes to situations like Bain Capital. And I wanted to find out, you know, we wanted to talk to you because of your analysis and also because you wrote a book on Obama. And so this would be a good time to check in and find out how this new approach towards politics within, you know, black politicians is playing out.
Right. Well, thank you for having me on. You know, the first thing that I'll say is, you know, I never really believed that Cory Booker was representative of a new class of black politicians. I think black politics has been complicated for a long time. But what happened was that there was a group of people who came into the foreground around the same time. They included people like Booker in Newark, like Adrian Fenty in Washington, D.C., Archer Davis, the former Alabama congressman, and Barack Obama being one. And also some people would put Harold Ford, former Tennessee congressman, from in that category as well. And they kind of became, you know, kind of brat pack of black politicians. They were, you know, many of them Ivy League educated. You know, Obama, Booker, you know, Archer Davis, all, you know, attended Ivy League institutions. Very fluent in terms of the way that they could move between black culture and white culture. People began to kind of wrongfully refer to them as post-racial politicians. And, you know, for a minute, it seemed as if they were capable of attracting significant amounts of black political support and also getting large amounts of white political support. And, you know, Cory Booker's comments on Meet the Press in defense of Bain Capital, in defense of, in a broader sense, private equity funds in general, were, you know, kind of indicative that these were a different type of black politician than what the public was accustomed to seeing on a big screen. And so, you know, you've been to Newark, I've been to Newark. One thing about Newark that it has a very solidly working class identity. You know, you come to Newark and you can kind of feel, you know, where the people are coming from, who they are. You know, I always joke and say, in Newark, you seem like if you go around any corner, there'll be somebody watching Ali fight Frazier on a color TV and somebody listening to James Brown, you know, in concert or something, because it gives you a feel for those kind of older cities, older American cities. It's impossible to think that you would have a mayor of a city as, you know, solidly working class as Newark is, giving this impassioned defense of the 1%, really. And, you know, it kind of goes to, you know, the dirty secret about Cory Booker, which is that he was much more popular outside of Newark than he is inside of Newark. As a matter of fact, when he ran for re-election in 2010, he won re-election, but he lost the black vote. He was able to get in because he had a coalition of other voters. But after outspending his rival, you know, by considerably, Cory Booker has a war chest of millions of dollars. He only got 58% of the vote, which is kind of underperforming. People were thinking someone with a national profile like him would mop the floor with any local candidate. But the fact of the matter is that what happens to Booker in Newark is kind of indicative of what we've seen happening in, you know, other instances. Adrian Fenty in Washington, D.C. Lost the black vote and lost the re-election. Archer Davis ran for governor, and he lost in a primary to a white candidate in which black voters were more than 50%. and he did not. He lost the black vote there too. And so what we're seeing is that what has happened, at least in those instances, are campaigns where these politicians have lost the black vote in pursuit or in seeming pursuit of white voters' interests and or corporate interests.
Well, let me ask you this, because you said that the black vote has always been complicated, and you were hesitant to put Booker in a category like that. But when you look at the trend, and you know, and you tell me, because I would defer to your expertise, it seems like that had been a switch in strategy, one that said, let's move away from depending upon the core of black folks to be your main support and really go after other voters. And we've seen that, and we've also seen the pushback as a result. I also just recall that early on, the lack of perceived connection to the black community were weapons that were used against these politicians at various times. Booker, when he ran against Sharp James, that was a call to him. Obama came under fire early on, where his blackness was questioned. And Fenty, as you mentioned, lost in D.C. because his rival, you know, pulled out the card that he's not connected to the black community. So can you kind of parse that out for us?
Right. There's a difference between making a cynical attack and making an attack that actually is based upon, you know, policies. And so when we saw President Obama in 2007, when people were saying that he wasn't really tied or connected to the black community, or he wasn't really black enough, and so on, that was silly because, you know, African-American voters make much more complicated decisions than that. But when you saw Adrian Fenty, when he ran, I mean, for the first time he ran for mayor, he won in every every ward in the District of Columbia, the traditionally black ones and the traditionally white ones. So that narrative about people not being connected to the black community didn't stick if someone was just saying, oh, okay, these politicians are all light-skinned, or all these politicians are biracial, or they've all gone to Ivy League institutions. The indication is that black voters didn't really care that much about that, that they were willing to give them a shot, that they thought that they were going to represent their interests. It's in the second go-round that people have looked around and said, well, we're not sure that this is working out for us. And in the case of Fenty, he did things that were just transparently bad political moves, one of which was hiring Michelle Rhee in a city that's majority black. If you're bringing in a non-black school chancellor, it's political. I mean, you can always go for the best person. That's what people should do. But in an instance like that, there's a certain way that it has to be done. And Michelle Rhee was widely perceived as being antagonistic to and disdainful of and condescending toward the black community. In other instances, there was one case with Dorothy Height and Maya Angelou wanted to meet with Adrian Fenty, and he blew them off. He didn't have time for them. Now, you know, there are two people in Washington, D.C., who had a great deal of reverence from everyday black folks, Maya Angelou and Dorothy Height, you know, the late Dr. Dorothy Height. And so that lost him the regard of many people in the black community. People began to say, well, can the people from the white districts get you on the phone? The people from the white areas get you on the phone? We know that we're not feeling that you have our best interests at heart.
But one might listen to that and say that's a disconnect to the black community. I think just on a very, you know, I won't use the word simplistic, but as you said, that's just a no-brainer. You know, Maya Angelou, or in the case of Dorothy Height, they call you meat because of their standing. It would be the same as if you go to the business community and somebody who's a titan in that particular arena, you sit down and you meet. But these politicians that you've mentioned in the New Yorker magazine, including Obama, time and time again, have seemed to go above and beyond to avoid appearing too black. Is that a fair criticism or assessment?
It's certainly the assessment of many of their voters. I think that the case of Obama is a little bit different because he is representing an arena, unlike Booker, unlike Arthur Davis, unlike Adrian Fenty, he's representing an arena where black voters are actually the minority. And I think that black people have tended to give Obama more of a pass on these things. Whether or not they should, you know, we can debate. But I think that Obama has tended to get something more of a pass on this than people like Booker have gotten. Because in those instances, Newark is, I believe, 55% black. You know, Washington, D.C. is still majority black. Arthur Davis's district in Montgomery, Alabama is majority black. And so these are instances where people are saying, okay, we are, you know, the bulk of your support, and we still feel that we're being you know, treated as if we are a Bantustan, a political Bantustan. And so I think that's one dynamic there. The other thing I want to say, make sure I say, is that there's a really good book on this that just came out by a political scientist at Emory University and a close friend of mine, Andrew Gillespie, and the book is called The New Black Politician, Cory Booker, Newark, and Post-Racial America. And she really delves into you know, the politics of how this has played itself out over these years. Now, coming back to the one other point that you know wanted to make about it is probably the biggest threat to Barack Obama's reelection possibilities, and we don't want to think about this in purely political terms, but it is a political element to this, was the Trayvon Martin issue. Precisely because this was a moment in which, had Obama not said anything, the public would have seen, at least the black public would have seen him as having, you know, ignored them at a crucial moment, or having seen, put the interest of being nonpartisan or being above the fray, above the interest of the black people who represent a quarter of his electorate. And so when he came out and made the statement, if I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon Martin, it was really a political masterstroke because the Obama campaign in 2012 is really not running against Mitt Romney. They're running against Barack Obama in 2008. And so if Barack Obama in 2008 can bring out these huge numbers of new voters and get elected, the question is, can the Barack Obama of 2012 do the same? If African Americans don't come out in the numbers that we came out, he will not get reelected. And so in that regard, he faces a issue that is not that different from what we've seen with these other politicians as well.
We're talking with author and professor Jelani Cobb this afternoon, looking at his article, Cory Booker, The New Dilemma for Black Politicians, which is an article that he wrote looking at a wave of black politicians and what they're facing. We started off by talking about the Cory Bookers, the Harold Fords, Arthur Davises, Adrian Fentys, Barack Obama. And you said you hesitated to put them in a category, that it was a little too simplistic. Let's reverse that a little bit. Do you think the black community has been put into to a category that's oversimplistic? And I'm looking at the complications that have arisen where people have looked and raised an eyebrow on positions taken like around same-sex marriage, which shows that there's a large number of black folks that have been very conservative, much more conservative than I think a lot of folks would have anticipated based upon voting records, which shows that we support Democratic candidates to the tune of 96-97%. So much so that oftentimes we get taken for granted. But then when an issue like that comes up, people are willing to break ranks, which has raised eyebrows. The conversation around equity, you know, there are people that can relate to that in the community. There are one percenters or very conservative swipes of people in the black community. So have we taken our community both inside and allowed folks on the outside to paint the black vote in an overly simplistic stroke?
Yeah, I think that you're right about that. One, you know, in terms of the gay marriage issue, there are issues in which the black community is very conservative. The other question is whether or not those are voting issues, however. When people say that they disagree with Barack Obama on the issue of gay marriage, that's not likely to be something that will be, you know, determine, you know, whether people come out to vote or how people vote in November. And, you know, if we were talking about very conservative African Americans and so on. That certainly is part of it. One of the things that I think has been very much oversimplified is the calculation that black people make when going into the voting booth. We have traditionally underestimated the complexity of black voting behavior, at least in kind of popular culture and media. You see that happening. The best example of that, I think, is the belief that black politicians are inherently going to win the black vote. There have been a number of instances, and I think 2006 was the kind of best example of it, number of instances in which black voters will overwhelmingly vote for white candidates over other African Americans. We saw that with Lynn Swann when he ran for, I believe it was governor in Pennsylvania, when Ken Blackwell ran for governor in Ohio, and even when Michael Steele ran for the Senate from Maryland, none of them got over 25% of the black vote. And as a matter of fact, Steele got the highest. I think he got like 24%. The rest of them were in the teens or low 20s. And so there is a number of kind of complexities. The shorthand thing is people say African Americans vote their interests and not their values. And so people disagree with the Democratic Party on issues of gay rights, or they disagree with the Democratic Party or the liberals on issues of abortion or school prayer or any of these things. Those are, substantive differences in values. But at least historically, they have not translated into a difference in terms of how African Americans vote. If they believe that their interests are best represented by people who are pro-labor union, people who are pro, a strong minimum wage, people who are pro, urban development and urban school development and so on, those are the things that are listed as generally being most important to black voters.
Is there a, do you parse up the black vote in terms of generation, region, and class when it comes to key issues? And let's start with the issue of class. Cory Booker talking about equities, the average person on the street, I want a paycheck. I don't know what this equity stuff is about, but we have a sizable number that could relate to him. And is that, I don't know if that's a good or bad thing, but how do we start breaking up the black vote in terms of behavior?
I think, the political scientists have been doing that for a long time. And I think that even when we look at Cory Booker, he's not pursuing the black vote. And the best example of that is this. Booker has a series of, has a commercial or campaign satire. I don't know what exactly it is, but it's a YouTube video that he made with Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, and, often mentioned possible vice presidential pick. Chris Christie is kind of making light of Cory Booker's reputation for being a crusading hero. A few weeks ago, he saved someone from a burning building, and he does these kinds of, heroics. And every time Chris Christie tries to do something great, Cory Booker has beaten him to the punch. At one point, Christie's car gets a flat tire, and he gets out to change it, and Booker is already there, like, on one knee and changing the tire. One, just on the optics of it, black people did not favor an image of their mayor, of their city, an African-American, on one knee in front of the white governor. That's just not something that was going to fly or to look very good with this black population in Newark. The other is that Booker has a very cozy relationship in general with Chris Christie, and the reality is that Chris Christie lost the county in which Newark sits by 40 points in his gubernatorial bid. So Christie is not popular with Booker's voters at all. And so where a politician would normally be wary of being that closely aligned with someone who their voters appear to not like very much, Booker, that hasn't stopped Booker at all.
Wow. What about generation? In terms of younger, older, do we see things playing out that way?
I can't really answer that because, I'm speaking of this from my perspective as a journalist and a historian, but what's happening generationally, I don't know what the numbers on that are. What I will say is that, many of the interests and causes have not changed. So young black people are concerned about the economy. They're concerned about over-incarceration. They're overly concerned about the relationship to the criminal justice system. They're concerned about the poor quality of our educations. And these are things that have been, unfortunately, intergenerational issues and concerns. Whether or not this new generation of black politicians is able to address that, I think remains to be seen.
We've been talking with author, historian Jelani Cobb, and it sounds like you got to get ready to get on a train or something. That's what it sounds like in the background. Well, look, I appreciate it, brother. We'll talk to you in a bit, okay?
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, I'm talking to you, girl. Yeah.
Peace. This is Brother Africa Bambaataa, godfather of hip-hop culture, and I'm on Hard Knock Radio, 94.1 KPFA, as they blow your funky mind, sucker.
What's gonna do?